Itential is intelligent automation for multi-domain and multi-vendor networks, and the Packet Pushers thank Itential for sponsoring today's episode. Find out more about Itential on Heavy Networking episode 503 and at www.itential.com/packetpushers.
There are many forms of automation. Routing protocols are a form of autonomous self-configuration automation, according to rigidly defined rules and limited possibilities. And networks are highly distributed systems, and autonomous protocols actually have very little capability for automation aside from adding a route, deleting a route against a set of very limited criteria. But it is automation. Now, in recent years, we've seen the rise of software controllers or software applications forging network configurations to become quite common and, in fact, every day. And more recently, we saw the rise of overlay networking, VXLAN in the data center, then IPsec and SSL in the SD-WAN, and now we're starting to see the emergence of overlays in the campus, the last bastion of heritage networking, if you will. And yet, heritage hardware-centric networking continues to be mainstream. It's quite frustrating that we still have to put up with VLAN and MPLS tag protocols that require complex software on every device. And recently, we have seen the LISP protocol get its chance in the limelight after 15 years in the wilderness, and this time, it's actually being pitched as a campus overlay protocol, led by Cisco in its software-defined access portfolio. Now, Corey Steele joins me today because he wants to make the case that protocols like LISP are a good idea. And I'm going to take the opposing side of the debate and make the case for overlay protocols like QoIC and TLS and the concept of end-to-end connectivity, or edge end-to-end connectivity, not network connectivity, is the way that we should go forward. So, Corey, welcome to the show. Thanks for biting the bullet on this.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for having me here.
No worries. Now, you do a lot of design and architecture for people. So let's just establish your credibility here. What have you been doing?
So I've been working with SD-WAN a lot. I've been working with all tiers lately. I've been doing some shift work where I get to do some tier one all the way up to tier three. Mm. I primarily focus on tier three architecture. I've been working a lot with ISPs in trying to get them to expand some of their portfolios of routing protocol options, such as, you know, things like BFD in simplicity or supporting communities. Some ISPs just don't support that. Sometimes all it takes is, a little bit of a conversation with the right people.
That's right. Okay, well, let's take our corners and commence the debate. Now, you contacted me and said, look, I'm a big fan of LISP. I think LISP is the way forward. You know, this idea of using controllers and RLOCs and all that sort of stuff is a good idea. And I'm not so sure. So why do you think LISP is a good idea?
LISP is a good idea because it can help you uncover the different places in the internet that you may not have known existed because you don't need to access them. And this is more so on a, you know, internet exchange standpoint and an ISP standpoint, where the ISP is connected to places they don't even know they're connected to. So how can you get connected to it? Well, sometimes the people who own the servers know exactly where they're connected, and that may be able to allow you to explore deeper depths or quicker transit or better latency to these destinations going through paths you didn't even know existed.
Right. So what you're alluding to there is the fact that because protocols like MPLS rely on best path only, it doesn't use redundant paths or backup paths. It can only use one only best path. Although that best path is calculated by something as dumb as BGP, it's not necessarily a good path. It's just a path that's randomly generated by a routing protocol.
Right. So when you have multiple endpoints that go across to different areas, we can take Google as an example or Apple. They have multiple ingresses to their networks, and they have multiple points where they connect to even other ISPs. They all do peerings with ISPs that you don't even know are there, and those being able to be shown somehow to get that visibility, I think LISP may be able to actually help accomplish getting the visibility in the network paths that we didn't even know we could take.
Right. So you're alluding to things like the LISP multi-homing feature, which lets you use redundant paths or multiple paths to a given subnet or a given IP address. It's a multi-homing capability if you configure the map server to support that.
Right. The end client doesn't need to know that they're technically multi-homed, but the end server is multi-homed. And if there are paths that you can take, and this does go into what you were speaking about before, where, you know, there's only simple route updates that you can do on some heritage devices or some older devices that automation can still technically work with. And, you know, using those devices, I think, can be kind of helpful here.
Yeah. Whereas I would take the view that what we are heading towards, or what we know is true, is that protocols like Lisp and its sister protocols like MPLS and VLAN tagging. See, I regard Lisp and VLAN tags and MPLS as all of the same family. And what happens with all of those is that they're in the network. That is, the devices in the network must participate in these protocols to be able to operate. And if there's lessons that we've learned from VLAN tags, is that it's actually not very efficient and not very scalable to do this stuff in the network. And what we do know from the lessons from SD-WAN, but increasingly from remote access, is that implementing end-to-end connectivity, so between the host, the two endpoints, the server and the client, is the only tunneling that matters. This idea of taking the network and slicing it up into pieces has failed consistently for the last 30 years. So as proof point, I will throw down on the table my frame relay card and my ATM card. They were all very Lisp-like. There were central services with mapping servers, and the paths were calculated through the network, and they didn't work because the network couldn't scale up. It couldn't hold enough paths. It couldn't handle.
And whose network was that?
Well, it was all telco grade, right?
Yeah. So what I'm saying, and any attempt, you know, to map those, yeah, it can fail. But if you keep it on an individual basis, if somebody wants to implement this, you don't rely on the ISPs. And as much as I like working with the ISPs to get them to do new things, I think that it should be encouragement to ISPs to start doing something like this. But for the purposes of integration at the simplest level, you really only need to have the application and the end client to support it. So, you know, you can run Lisp on Linux, Windows. It's just a protocol, and you can run that on, you know, a processor. And will it be amazing? No, but will it work? Yeah.
But the problem I have with Lisp in lots of different ways is it's a very simple protocol in the sense it's a map and encap. So what you do is when the packet comes in from the user to an edge somewhere, usually a switchboard, it then gets encapsulated into something, right? So it gets encapsulated in another IP address. And that IP address is then forwarded across the network according to some path. That conceptually is exactly the same way that MPLS or VLAN tagging works. Because once you've got the tag, you then path the frame or path the IP packet according to the tag that you've added to it. And we do the same thing with encapsulated protocols in the data center. So
That's on the switch. The switch needs memory. The switch needs resources to keep all of that. The switch is finite. The end clients are semi-finite, but more towards the infinite side. Each one of them has way more than enough processing power to receive the paths. And taking a central controller, you just run the query against the controller. I'm trying to get to, you know, this service. And the big one right now is, you know, game streaming. You know, Google went down hard on that one, and, you know, we're waiting to see how they do. But, you know, when you're able to take something like a game streaming application and do an RLOC lookup, SRV lookup, and get all of those details about what your options are, and then run your path calculations against them from your real-time position, you may find that, you know, out of those five choices, one of them was not so great. And being able to keep track of those metrics, even if it means taking that metric, pushing it one step out to the edge for that path calculation to keep track of your SLAs, so to speak, and reroute you if necessary. It could be done at the edge. It could be done at the user endpoint. And it could be rerouted because it's all in the protocol. And your address isn't technically changing. You're just changing where you're encapsulating the destination.
Exactly. So what you're alluding to there, I think, is the fact that Lisp is an attempt to get away from the addressing follows topology. So I'm connected to the subnet. That's where I am. My source IP defines everything about me. It defines location and it defines my identity. In the case of Lisp, when the packet comes in and then gets encapsulated in a tunnel, Lisp is actually able to know that you might move from place to place. So there is some concept of endpoint mobility in there by overloading certain factors in the theory of it. It splits the architecture so that the endpoint can move around the network and the encapsulation process can follow it and change if the endpoint can signal to the network that I'm moving from here to here to here to here. That's what you're alluding to, right?
From a mobility standpoint, yes. I think that there's building it from layer one up and going layer seven down. I think I started at layer seven and you're looking at layer two, three, maybe four.
Yeah, I always read it back in the opposite direction to try and explain it, but yes.
Okay, that's fine.
So this idea of location mobility or endpoint mobility is something that we've tried to do fairly solidly for the last 30 years. Everybody's talked about it. And I'll also point you to mobile IP. I don't know if you remember mobile IP, but it was another attempt to try and do location-independent routing of IP datagrams on the internet.
I loved mobile IP. I remember reading the IPv6 mobile IP RFC, and yes. I said, I want this yesterday, because the care of concept was beautiful. I loved
it. The implementation was appalling. So as somebody who wasted something like 4 months of his life trying to make it work as part of a large team, there was several months of people's lives just flushed down the toilet or into a hellhole. It just couldn't work. None of these protocols were stable enough. The devices on which they were based could not, the code quality was so poor, they just wouldn't stay up. And it was the dream of telcos at the time to be doing mobile IP in the network so that users, they wouldn't have to do handset handoff as you go from tower to tower.
Yep.
Remember, right? And in the end, what they developed was another protocol called 3GPP, not unlike Lisp conceptually, by the way. And it would actually let you roam from tower to tower, but let you keep the same IP address as you wandered around the network because it was actually handed off. So it turns out that all the things that we thought we wanted mobile IP to do in the IP layer was actually solved in the cellular network. Again, another failure for these types of protocols. Still there?
I'm still here. I have no idea how to respond to that.
That's right. Okay. So the next point I'll say is that there's one good thing about Lisp, though, and I think Lisp is actually important because although we're talking about it being in the campus, one of the interesting parts is that I'm seeing a lot of SD-WAN companies use a Lisp-like protocol, this concept of a mapping server and the concept of the SD-WAN device waking up and registering with a remote mapping server, and then it controls the IPsec tunnel or the TLS tunnel. And then, you know, it's able to do the multi-homing and the path balancing and all that sort of stuff. So I'm not against Lisp per se. Probably the thing that I am most against, because of, you know, three decades of working in networking and the sheer point futility of getting networking devices to actually do stuff reliably. And I just feel like if we started to put these, you know, we talk about in Lisp, we talk about RLOC servers, map servers. There's about a half a dozen different points of registration and they all have to be redundant. And if you start connecting Lisp networks with other Lisp networks, so you start going into federated Lisp overlays, you have dozens of servers. And a lot of these networking companies are trying to tell me that Lisp has to be in a switch or in a router because that's the only place that you can put it because it has to be in the network. And that absolutely grinds my gears because every time we put complex protocols in a router or a routing device, we fail. We fail over and over and over.
We need to have the ability to push some complex information to that device. We do not necessarily need to be able to have that device compute it.
Yes. So when we start putting the ETR and the ITR in a, you know, BFR, big fancy router, right? That's when we fail, because this stuff should not be in the network. In my view, it should be over the network. Now, let me jump into the realms of hypothetical, theoretical design, architectural strategy type stuff, right? When I go back and look at the emergence of IP as a protocol, IP was designed as a connectionless, datagram-oriented service. Its only thing that we do at the IP layer is connect two endpoints together. This one will inject a packet. It has no idea if the packet will get to the other end. It doesn't know the path. It doesn't. All it knows is that I need to send it to this with this destination address, add my source address and a few other fields, and cross your fingers and hope that it works. That's the fundamental theory of operation between the IP protocol. Mm. And then what we did was we added on top of it protocols like TCP or UDP. And back in the days, we used to have other protocols operating at layer four of the OSI model, right? But right now, that's all we have left. So TCP actually only sees a stream of data from the application to the adjacent application, right? And what I'm saying is TCP is a map, is an overlay network that traverses over IP, if you look at it right. Do you agree with that?
I would agree that TCP is another layer. Yeah. I mean, if you're thinking about it from an encapsulation standpoint, it's technically the same thing. I mean, whether you're adding an MPLS tag, whether you're adding a VLAN tag, it's just a matter of how long does that tag stay on there and when will it be removed?
You're still only handling you're not handling the data stream. You're only handling the frame or the packet, right? You still don't care, and you're still not guaranteeing the end-to-end connectivity. You don't even know about the endpoints because the intermediate devices in the network only see the datagram, whether it's an IP pack, IP datagram, or an Ethernet datagram.
And that's why it's the end user's job now, I think. The end user device's job to keep track of those metrics and know what paths you have available. Otherwise, you're not going to get a quality experience.
Okay. Now, that would be true for small networks where it would be possible to gather information about the network. But what we also know is that people get more value from connecting to the internet than connecting to private, small, controlled networks where multiple paths might exist, right? And what we know from the internet is that if we just give people enough bandwidth, none of this actually matters, right?
So I wish we could give everybody a terabit to their house with 500.
Well, we don't actually need. What we know is the secret's about today. It's about 200 megs because you can't. Most households would struggle to saturate 200 meg down, 20 meg up. But it's generally the data we're seeing coming out of sort of telcos. And if we look at what Netflix talks about for streaming data and that sort of stuff, they're sort of saying that anybody who's got more than, you know, 25, 50 meg down are not seeing congestion in their paths. It's only in countries where the bandwidth is slower than that. Now, let me come back to this. So if you take my point that TCP is an overlay network, which it is, right? Then you also got to see that TLS is an overlay network as well. So there's possibility of actually having another overlay, an encrypted overlay happening at, say, layer 5, 6 of the OSI stack. So equally UDP, and this is where QUIC comes along. So QUIC is a protocol which is UDP-like or UDP similar. It's congruent with UDP, which actually compresses the TLS and the UDP into a single layer and forms an overlay over a stream overlay over the top of IP.
So let's take a step back here and let's talk about DNS. Let's talk about SRV records and how that might be something to be in comparison to this. You know, are you familiar with how SRV record lookups work?
So basically the idea is that DNS is the best database in the world, which it is. This is true. And you want to, if you could put records in against it, SRV service records, which are just, and agree some format, you could basically use the DNS for almost anything, like geographic data. Where is this site located? You could register your IP addresses and hand back geographical coordinates of where this this host is, if you know where they are.
Right. And Lisp does a very similar thing, but a little differently. And I think taking that concept of SRV records, where you can do a record lookup and get 5 servers back and be able to do some metric test against those 5 points. It's very much in line with your overlay concept that if both of these are just overlays, I think the real important thing is taking metrics on what overlays you have available to you, whether it's the same LTE connection taking a different ingress path. Sometimes just going through a different IXP makes the world of difference. And knowing that those IXP paths are available to you for the best experience.
And this would be a challenge for Lisp because you're trying to do that at internet scale and having nodes inside of the internet so that you could discover multiple paths isn't practical. You can only do Lisp inside of a small enough network where you know the underlying architecture. So let me just recategorize that a little bit. Lisp is not specifically, it does work over the internet because it can. It encapsulates at the edge. It's a map and encap, right? I know where the source is. I look up a mapping server and then I encap it and then the encap flows. So it works at data center scale. It works at campus scale. But that's because it has some awareness from the underlying routing protocol about the available paths between two endpoints, right? So it knows that multi-homing exists and it can engage its multi-homing capabilities if the underlying routing protocols can tell it that there are multiple paths to the destination.
Well, when you do a DNS lookup, sometimes you get 5 different IPs.
Yes. That's another way of doing it. And they're still working on the Lisp protocol in the ITF. I stopped getting in touch with it a couple of years ago. Maybe I should go back and get up to date. There's a lot of activity happening around that Lisp protocol in the ITF. Has been since 2009, I want to say. So Lisp has been rattling around for a long period of time, looking for a home. Originally, it was pitched as a data center technology. And then people thought MPLS was going to be the protocol. And then eventually became EVPN. It was VXLAN. largely due to NSX. And then later on, you know, NSX still doesn't care what the underlay is in your data center. It just assumes that you're solving the problem with bandwidth. So to come back to our original problem here, my issue here is that I can use Lisp in small networks inside the enterprise. But the point that I would take is that we've got to understand that the consumer market is so much greater than the corporate market. Now, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, corporate IT was the dog that wagged the tail. So corporate IT produced laptops. People at home could buy laptops. Corporate IT needed laser printers. Sometime eventually, laser printers were developed that people could buy at home. And that was the development path. These days, smartphones are built for consumers, not for corporate IT, because corporate IT is a trivial use case. And smartphones, like Apple doesn't barely care about the enterprise IT market at all. It does some stuff, but mostly it says, here, Cisco, you guys sort that out for us. You know, we'll have a partnership with somebody and they can just, you know, whatever. We'll do the bare minimum we have to do. So my point is that if you want to be successful in corporate IT, you need to be looking at what's happening in consumer IT, which is so huge. 7 billion people out there use the internet. And the reason that SD-WAN is successful, in my view, is because there's a, you know, there's so much consumption of that one network, that internet, that everybody can connect to it, that it doesn't make sense to have private networks anymore. And when it comes to defining network slices, now that made sense 25 years ago when networks were precious diamonds to be shared out in little tiny fragments and each person got a little tiny bit of bandwidth and everything took years to build and, you know, running an undersea cable was difficult. But now we've got undersea cables being deployed in 6 months. They're clocking 200 gigs and 400 gigs per fiber. They're using erbium-doped amplifiers to be able to do almost perfect amplification of signals without having to do active termination and re-encoding and retransmission like we did back in the early 2000s. We can just throw bandwidth at these problems. We don't need networking slicing, as far as I can see, at all. What we need is a way to efficiently do overlays over the public network. And at this point, not convinced that Lisp does that for me. And if it is, if there are ways, nobody's telling me about them.
I think security is a chief concern in networking. And when it comes to establishing TLS sessions with direct, just using the TLS as an overlay, there's a lot of visibility that's lost there that I think Lisp may be able to help with from the standpoint of providing user authentication to applications. And I disagree. I think networks should be private, but not in the way you think. I'm not saying everyone should use RFC 1918, but I think routes that don't need to be on the internet shouldn't be. Let's take an example from MPLS and let's only put our nodes that are capable of decapsulating that traffic. You know, that's, I think, the main point is if you want to get into our network, you have to ask us first. And here's our entry point. And I think Lisp could act as that entry point. I think TLS is a good option, but TLS is, I think, more centric on web server traffic. You could probably use it, but I think that Lisp being that deciding factor on whether or not you get in, you can really take something from that and add some tokens onto it to really add a nice form of SSO and make it very stateless. And I think that's where the benefits come in.
So again, I think what you're saying is you want the network to be active in the authentication engine is what I think you're saying there.
I'm not
to be part of it. No?
I'm saying that the point of demarcation being the application service provider, not the internet service provider, should be authenticating at the network level. Yes. I'm not saying the ISP should though.
Hey, we're pausing the podcast to tell you about Itential. I mean, technically the podcast is still going on because you're hearing these words, but yeah, you know what I mean. Okay, Itential. This company's core function is network automation. But what does network automation mean these days? Let's be more specific here, since a whole bunch of vendors plus three dudes from Stanford with angel funding and a Mac in their garage also claim to offer network automation. So fair enough, specifics. Itential is a network automation platform. Think of Itential as a middleman between you and network infrastructure. Itential offers a network API, federating functionality and data from controllers and orchestrators and network management tools. In other words, you talk to Itential via their network API. Itential talks to everything else for you. It's easy to use, it scales, it's multi-domain, and it's vendor agnostic. And if you're thinking, wait, we're already deep into Ansible and some other tools helping us with automation. Would we have to throw all of that away to use Itential? No, you would not, because Itential is designed to work with what you have already. So your existing work in Ansible, etc., that's not wasted. You don't have to reinvent your automation from scratch. Instead, think about unifying the domains you live in, cloud and SD-WAN, data center, wireless, and network applications, all around a common interface. Imagine simplifying your network operations, reducing the amount of glue code that you have to maintain, ignoring the zillion or so different APIs sitting in front of all the different networking gear you have. You can expose a consistent network primitive to developers writing code for the operations teams. You can build all of that, exactly that, on the Itential automation platform, supporting the entire lifecycle of your network automation processes. Oh yeah, I said lifecycle. Make sure the network is running like it's supposed to via Itential. Close that loop. For more detailed information about Itential, I have two recommendations for you. First, go listen to Heavy Networking episode 503. We talked to CTO Chris Wade about the Itential automation platform, and we get pretty nerdy about it. Second, go visit www.itential.com/packetpushers. So again, that's Heavy Networking episode 503 and itential.com/packetpushers. And now, back to today's show.
So one of the things that people like about Lisp is that it can do the authentication at the mapping server. So when the person connects at the edge and they attempt to form a Lisp tunnel, you can check whether there's a map for that IP address, and then you can start to trigger an authentication process, right? And you can link the Lisp to the 802.1x. That's how I understand the ICE and the SD access works together, ISE.
Yeah, yes, yes.
For the Cisco product family in this space, right? Now, that sounds really attractive until you go and look at companies who are implementing zero trust security. So companies like Cisco's Duo Security Division. Cisco recently bought Duo Security to be able to get the successor to ICE. And this is where, when you authenticate to an application, I don't necessarily know where you're coming from. I don't want to have to trust a single network. What I need is a way to identify users from multiple factors. So is this a computer that I've seen before? Is the username password correct? Is this user up to date? Is this computer doing anything that I haven't seen before? Can I use some sort of biometric or some sort of two-factor?
Which all smartphones do. We do single sign-on on smartphones all the time. I mean, you just hop on the network, you sign into your Google account, and
Duo security stuff is really, really clever. It sort of fingerprints your whole application and you and your activity.
I've worked closely with it.
Yeah, right. And it is absolutely, in my view, it's the future of authentication for users. And that's because it puts it in the application. And it's like what Google does for zero trust networking. It says, we don't care whether you're coming in on the internet or whether you're coming in from an internal network. It's all the same to us. We don't differentiate. But what we do is take a lot of trouble around when you log into Google, and we secure your cookies, and we watch what's happening in your browser. That's the sort of thing. That, to me, is the successor protocol or the successor security future that we're going to go to. So anything that you do in the campus, to me, and we're coming back to focusing on Lisp in the campus here now, is a dead end, because I think eventually the campus is just going to be a low-cost method to access an internet gateway somewhere. And if you try to implement some sort of authentication and authorization in the campus, you're going to be blindsided in 3 to 5 years by a whole different way of working, and it's going to be a wasted investment.
I disagree. I think it makes things easier. I think being able to get on the internet and them know who's on the internet is not only safer for companies, safer for users. And let's imagine you're home and you're sitting in your living room and your friend comes by and they try and connect to their Wi-Fi or your Wi-Fi. You just get a notification. Hey, somebody's trying to connect. You know who it is? Yes. Boom, they're allowed. Do you know who it is? Yeah, they're my friend. All right, we'll put them on the guest network. Or no, it's my mom. All right, we'll put her on the restricted network.
Yes, that's right. Exactly that sort of thing. And they get privileges and tagged and all that sort of stuff. And this is where I get a little frustrated with this idea of Lisp and its integration with SGT, security group tags, and all of this type of stuff. Because I actually think we're missing the point here is we're still separating the network from the applications. And what we really need to be working on is applications, not the network in isolation. And ultimately, there are solutions for application security and application integrity that use data from the network. But we've got to stop looking at the network as the place to implement this and think it's got to be done further up the stack. And so I'm not opposed to doing these things as a short-term fix or a hack, as long as you understand this is a short-term hack while we wait for things to change in the application stack.
I think it would be great if everyone could adopt IPv6. We can use all those powerful tools. I mean, SRv6, this and that. I think that it would be great if we could get to a pure internet, but I think we're still working ourselves out of IPv4. And until we get there, yeah, we're just going to have a lot of band-aids.
Yeah, well, I think IPv6 is going to be great because you're going to actually have a guaranteed source identifier, a unique source IP.
Yes, no, I agree, 100%.
And that changes security model a lot when you can actually trust the source. And that's an interesting question. So IPv6 will fix it, and it will come. It'll continue at its incremental growth over time, I suspect. Although for a lot of people who are connecting directly to mobile networks, you're getting IPv6 now and you don't know about it.
Yes.
And increasingly, enterprises are being forced to put IPv6 into their public-facing gateways. It's interesting that the public network will force IPv6 first, not the private network. This is, again, this consumer corporate, like corporate IT is not driving IPv6, and it will probably push back against it for as long as it can. And I certainly understand that. But the consumer market is, let me put this out there, right? The reason that you have a campus network is because it's cheaper than using a 3G, 4G, 5G network, right? If you could imagine the best possible way to have a network in the future is everybody's devices just come with some sort of mobile wireless capability, and then you don't actually have to build a campus network at all. It's not your problem. They should just connect to a telco somewhere, some sort of cloud network, telco mobile network, and you won't have a campus network in 5 to 10 years.
In a perfect world, that would be nice, but I still think we'll be relying on campus networks because I think that we'll be relying on campus networks for our last miles now, those access points.
Yeah.
I don't think it's just going to be the phones. I mean, when you think about all of the phones who have to be connected to a single tower or multiple towers, even with 5G and millimeter wave, you still want to have some aggregation point so that you're not just blasting radio waves everywhere. So yeah. Even then, you need to know who your closest point or what path you can take, whether that's through five other people's phones that you're using as a mesh, or if it's to a cell tower that's running 400 megahertz 20 miles away. But the point is being able to make it have a good user experience. I think that we're going to be putting a lot of LTE radios into our access points, I think, because...
Well, it's possible. I'm not sure I see 5G, private 5G as a thing. I suspect that's there's a lot of complexity in that. And
I just see it as backhaul, private 5G. Yeah. It can still be a regular 5G internet connection. You don't need network slicing. You just need some public IP addresses to be distributed.
That's right. I think at the end of the day, my view is that we're going to see a lot more people working from home. Obviously, as we record this, it's the middle of April and the COVID-19 situation is still evolving. Mm-hmm. But some of the articles that I'm reading from the major consulting firms is they're predicting a 40% increase of people working from home for the next year. And that's mm-hmm. probably a permanent. So if your offices, if your university campuses, if your those types of institutions where you used to have thousands of workers coming into a central location just to access computers and to sit next to each other, that actually may not be a thing going forward. You might see a major disruption point where those campuses suddenly empty out of, 30 to 40% of people just stop coming to their desks on a nearly continuous basis. I suspect it's going to be a very difficult thing to sort out over time. You're going to see people coming to work one day a week, whereas today they work from home one day a week. So mm-hmm. I think there'll be an inversion there.
I think school is going to be the big impact here is how are people going to learn? How are you going to get internet connection to, the children?
How are you going to give the same level of service to everybody? I think schools will, there's a valuable part of schools as well with socialization mm-hmm. and peering and human relationships. And I think that schools will continue. But universities, like, why am I paying to accommodate at a university? Why am I paying $100,000 a year to sit in a lecture?
In your living room and do the same thing?
Yes. Now, for sure, there's a transition that has to happen there. and it's probably a forced transition. But right now,
the cost savings from an institutional standpoint, I mean, you know.
Well, from a student, forget the institutions, who cares about them? It's from the students. Like if you're in a country where you're like the government is paying for students paying $50,000 per year per student, or in the US, a student is paying $100,000 a year to be in a lecture theater, right? Mm-hmm. Well, if all of a sudden I can just push them out and the student's going to say, there's a campus over here, there's a university over here that's got a good name, a good brand. They're going to charge me $20,000 a year and I can stay at home in my mum's bedroom for another $20,000 a year. I'd be better off doing that.
Yeah. Well, now all of your lectures and your research and all your calls are over the internet, right?
Yes. Now there's an application problem there. There's a social problem. You're mm-hmm. still going to probably want to go to your institution and, you know, meet your teachers, have communicate. There's still a social aspect to this that's important. But I'm not entirely sure that education, we need, like a lot of these big campuses are in universities or mm-hmm. in our offices. Do they survive? And then if they suddenly shrink by some amount over the next 5 years, does just giving everybody a smartphone and tethering, does that start to get more attractive?
I think what gets really attractive is trying to get the local communities to solve some of these internet issues, get the local schools to figure out creative ways to get people internet so that they can continue to learn. Because I think there are a lot of people who don't have the means to be able to telecommute or telepresence themselves.
Given everybody, how does everybody get access to the internet is certainly a problem. There's not everybody's got enough money to have a $1,000 computer and a $15 a month. That's a problem, but it's still cheaper than $100,000 at university, right?
Absolutely. Yes. Right? And that's what I think that's why we should be innovating and figuring out these creative solutions.
Well, that's not my problem or yours. We're here to talk about
I get it.
So, you know, coming back to the protocols, I think I like Lisp because it's a scalable version of MPLS in the same sense, right? Mm-hmm. What I don't like about Lisp is that it still comes down to this concept of network slicing, that I have to slice the network in some way, where in the long term, what I actually want to do is respect the fact that I have an edge device, which is a smartphone or a laptop or a computer of some sort, connecting to an application. And that application, no matter what we do in the network, ultimately forms its own overlay, whether it's HTTPS or TCP. Why are we running overlays over overlays? What's the value of those slices? So I guess when you know, we're using EVPN in the data center, and a lot of companies are going to take EVPN into the campus as a way of selling more switches and providing slicing, because MPLS in the campus is never going to scale because MPLS is too resource intensive.
Let's think about routing tables. Internet routing tables are how big now? Over 1 million routes?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Which is great. Finally, but the faster you grow the routing tables, the faster ISPs are forced to upgrade their routers. And that means more speed and more modern routers, potentially even with software that works.
See, I think that with Lisp, you can reduce the routing table size dramatically if you're only showing the routes that you need. Why, you know, it's the same concept as MPLS in the core. You don't run BGP. You run OSPF in the core and it gets all of the, you know, all the tags. And it routes on that. It's a smaller routing table. Yeah, you have the LDP table, but it's much more efficient. And it's the same concept that the edge is querying for how it gets somewhere, and it gets a single or multiple IPs, but you don't need to have public IP addresses for all of your services because they're not really public. Nobody's website is public.
No, but they're just unique.
Yeah, I mean, right. Some websites are, quote, public, but, you know, if you want to go to your Gmail or you want to go to your Google Photos, that's not a public server. That's a private server that you're getting that data from. So why are you reaching out to a public IP that's, you know, is, you know, proxied through to that server when you can, you know, that route is on the internet? There's no reason for it to be on the internet because if you need access to it, you should be authenticated. And if you're authenticated, then the route gets to you, not the internet. It's only the next hops, the endpoints, the points of demarcation that should be on the internet.
Hmm.
Points of ingress.
But see, this is what we've got the same problem here with direct connect into cloud companies. So you're sort of suggesting something along the same lines there? Is that what I understand?
Not exactly the same, but from a authentication standpoint, the user is able to, after authenticating, get it. I mean, if you want to say, yeah, if you go through the process with AWS and you're in a data center and they verify who you are, they give you a 1 gig line to your rack. It's not necessarily the same, but you, in essence, yeah, you're validating who you are So you get more information because we can validate who you are.
Okay.
Why are the public internet routing tables advertising everyone? Not everybody needs or wants to be known on the internet, but we need to keep track of the people securely. And I think Lisp can help with that. I think it can help us keep track of those things.
We don't need to track people on the internet. That's not the purpose. The ITF goes to extreme lengths to secure the protocols. Mm-hmm. So now it is possible for people operating at scale, Google, Facebook, et cetera, to track you as you move around the internet because it can fingerprint you for various
devices. Not the ISP. We don't want the ISP tracking us. We just want the people we want to know about us to be able to. Right now, you have a public IP address. You know, anybody can just start running a scan on it because it's on the internet. I'm not saying that you shouldn't use public addresses and you shouldn't advertise them, but you know, zero trust is a thing. And I think that this is a good way to get us to zero trust. And it doesn't rely on the ISPs. It allows the application developers to say, you know what, I want to try this. Let me try it. And it allows them to put it in their applications and see if you know, it works. You know, how great would it be to have zero online presence except for a single IP that everything still works because the user signed into their account. That's it.
Yeah. So my point then would come back to the consumer market again and say, everybody in the consumer market, 7 billion people on the planet, you know, there's 4.5 billion people on the planet today who have a smartphone connected to the public internet. Those people are going to define the future of applications and services. And they are not going to use Lisp. The telcos that run underneath them are not going to use Lisp. They're going to be running the 3GPP.
The application owners have to do it.
And they're moving to native IP. They're not going to run Lisp up there. They're not. They'll use MPLS for certain things, but mostly it'll be to be able to have just three or four slices inside their network for their own purposes. At the end of the day, my point would be is that you have to copy. If you're running corporate IT and you're doing strategically designing, you can look at what's happening in the consumer market and everybody is just going to be connected bare naked to the public internet. And that's where we're all going to go. And the only way to run a cost-effective system for remote access, for remote users, for customers accessing your resources, doing B2B transactions, so where your accounting system needs to upload data to a bank, where you need to share invoices with a partner, or where you need to send invoices to your customers, that's all going to happen on the public internet. And that is the future. So any systems that you build that doesn't follow that trend strikes me as dead end.
It would all be encapsulated over the public internet. Just like MPLS, it's all encapsulated. The core routers don't need to know anything except the endpoint. They don't care about the state. They don't care about the endpoint. So to me, it makes things simpler from a global internet scale. It does push a little bit more on the application developers to actually try this, but I think that it's, you know, using OAuth should be fairly easy. You know, you push the OAuth SSO token to the edge. The
IoT is where we're at now, but yeah.
Firewalls, I mean, they, you know, you can easily push a token and say, hey, this token's going to come in. It's 802.1x. Hey, this just came in. Just so you know, you can allow them through. You know, somebody taps the firewall on the shoulder and says,
yeah, now
hey,
we won't have firewalls. Firewalls are because the point is
not
that
necessarily
firewall
but.
Yeah, but a filter. There'll be a filter somewhere in the pipeline or an inspection engine. And if we use the word firewall as an inspection engine, I mean, we're already at the point where 80% of the internet traffic is HTTPS. What's the point of a firewall?
I like inspection engine. That's probably better. Yeah.
So we need an inspection engine then to be fingerprinting the HTTPS connections.
And that would be at your points of ingress to your networks.
It might actually be on the application itself or on the log files streaming off it. So what we're seeing is either S-flow type stuff, flow-based records analysis to determine if there's malicious activity. And a lot of people now are actually putting agents, we're seeing a return to the HIDs, host intrusion detection systems, where it actually goes into the container or into a sidecar or into, dare I say it, a service mesh type of thing inside of the server side to actually detect that type of activity.
Yep. I've seen stuff like that. It spins up containers or VMs to scan it.
But none of that is in the network. This is not much of it pains me to say it. These things aren't suited to being in the network. The initial intention of the OSI model when it was, you know, instantiated back in the mid-80s when they finally got it was that the purpose of the IP network was to just let untrammeled connectivity between endpoints happen and let innovation happen above the stack. And then over time, we realized that we need to set up stream-based services. And if you go back and read the RFCs between 1 and 2000 and get into the history of the internet, you'll realize it took them a long time to get to TCP, which is a bit weird, but there you go. Mm-hmm. The TCP protocol that sits off the top is actually a byte stream, or it's a stream-orientated protocol that forms an overlay over IP. That's it. That is all we ever need. And increasingly, we don't need TCP anymore because we're doing it in UDP because for various reasons. That's why QUIC exists. We talked about that a lot on the show, so I won't rehash it here.
Yep. I know.
Yeah. But my view is that anything that's done in the network, like Lisp or VLAN tags or MPLS tagging or EVPN overlays, can only happen in very small networks. And they solve very specific, very narrow problems. And I can't see them lasting for very long because they don't actually have enormous value. I can, and as I've said, I think the big reason that Lisp is a short-term campus protocol is because the long-term says everybody will just connect to the 5G network. Why would I even have a campus?
Yeah, I think that we still need a campus, though. I think that 5G is great, but today we will need both. Tomorrow, who knows? I hope that we can move towards IPv6 native, but we have to do what we can to make things better and get people to that IPv6. And I think
one of the other problems that Lisp struggles wrong is hardware limits at the edge. So you still got problems with TCAMs and CPU and memory and all that stuff, because the edge nodes still have to have the ETRs and the ITRs to be able to locate the RLOCs and to set up the tunnel state. So the edge boxes still need to happen. And the lesson that we learned from MPLS is that a lot of devices just don't have that capacity, or don't want to have that capacity, or the vendors want to charge handsomely for such capacity and won't take a balanced viewpoint at it.
That's definitely a problem that I think we should try and get vendors to look a little bit better at in terms of pricing and development.
Well, I don't think it's up to the vendors. I think it's up to customers. The customers are paying the prices today. They don't care how much it costs. They're paying whatever the vendor asks. And the vendors are able to make enormous profit margins for very little effort and sell low quality products. And we accept all the problems, right? You've heard me talk about this many times, right? Mm-hmm. So the point here is it's up to the customer to either demand a simpler product and get a lower price for it, or to move to a disaggregated product, a low cost, like a white box, if you want to use that name. But increasingly, I'm moving away from white box because it's used as a negative or to denigrate the value of that. And just say, like, really, all I want is an IP network that's open access. And my endpoints are the endpoints, and my network is just a way to access the core network. And that's it. That's all it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, if you wanted to add SSO as a secondary form, you could. But I think it's important to have the option open. I think that we should be researching and testing Lisp to make the internet safer for the most part. It's really that all of those public IP addresses that are on the internet are unnecessary. And I think that we can really reduce that.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about that. I think that there's definitely value in IPv6 giving everybody a unique identifier. And that unique identifier lets us know that that is a genuine source. And if we could trust that that was unique, there's absolutely a security value in that.
Well, I'm talking more on the destination. I'm kind of worried about, you know, the source, like people attacking other servers, but I'm more worried about a destination being on the internet that has no need to be on the internet. And you know, using Lisp, you would be able to take those off the internet.
My point would be, I agree with your point from a heritage point of view. That is, that's the way we've done it, and putting up a perimeter has value, and there still will always be, but I think we should be embracing this. Our servers should just be connected to the internet. So if I spin up a VM in my provider, my compute provider, and I give it a public IP address, it's connected to the internet. I don't put a firewall on it. None of my blogs have firewalls. Mm-hmm. Why would I put a firewall in front of that thing? Why would I put a special network between them? It doesn't need, I think if we moved more towards this idea that everything's just in the public domain on a public network, accessible to everybody.
And then let the application developers about securing their things.
You know, you have a whole bunch of stuff that has to happen there. But the flip side of this is connectivity. One of the things that I've learned very recently with SD-WAN is connectivity is its own reward. So for example, in the case of SD-WAN, they build this beautiful overlay using a Lisp-like protocol. You know, the SD-WAN server wakes up, registers with a central mapping server, which then tracks all the tunnels and handles the encapsulation and blah, blah, blah. And it also handles crypto keys and a whole bunch of other stuff that Lisp doesn't do, right? Now, the point here is that once you're all on the internet, now I can I can do split tunneling at my branch and send my internet traffic off to a scanning service. Select your favorite CASB, Zscaler, for example, send it into there and get all your logging and all your scanning. Now, that's not something that you could ever do before. Or maybe you want to eject flow records from the SD-WAN branch and send it off to Kentek for scanning. And now, because you're on the global network that everybody sees the same is, you can start to use services like ThousandEyes to monitor the network for you.
And then look for anomalies.
So now everybody's got the same network. Sort of. It's not the same. We know it's a network of networks, but you can now start to use tools that are consistent for everybody. So in the same way that we have Python and Java for programming, we start to get to the point where everybody's on the internet, so everybody's got the same network and the same problems, and we start solving that problem. And the sooner we get to that, I think the better off networking will be. Now, that is not going to happen in a hurry because that is not an idea that is widespread and that is easy. I mean, look at us. We've been talking about it for 50 minutes and we're just starting to narrow in on the fundamental issue here. And the second issue is that everybody finds the internet big, scary thing while conveniently forgetting that they use it at home and on their smartphones every day. And it just seems to work pretty well on the whole, right? Yeah. And I think that a lot of people don't know how to retool. And also there's a very entrenched market of vendors selling products. They have substantial goals and purposes to sell switches and routers and security tools on private networks. And they will try and extend the life of that legacy for as long as possible. So not a problem. That is perfectly viable. It's up to the customer to make the decisions here, not the vendor. The vendor will sell whatever the customer wants. And as a customer, you should be saying, I want everything on the internet, all the way from my call center staff to my CEO to my cleaners. They should all just be using smartphones or whatever. And that ultimately is why I'm not opposed to Lisp per se. I think it's a fine protocol insofar as it goes. But every time I try and look at what the network does, I'm thinking, I want to do something on top of the internet. I don't want to do it on top of a private network because that's just a temporary fix while we wait to move to the next phase.
Yeah. Well, I got to say, it's been a pleasure talking with you, Greg.
I enjoyed this. This was great. You did get me. You almost had me at one point, and then I've stood my ground.
Where did I almost have you? I need to know.
I think when we were talking about Lisp for authentication and the campus, there is definitely a place for it. And there was a key point when we were prepping for the show, and I realized that SD-WAN, which is one of my most favorite trends for now, is actually very Lisp-like, this whole idea of mapping services.
What is it called? Yeah, what is it called?
Well, I think most of them are using a Lisp-like protocol. So they take whatever, they develop their own.
Yes. Some derivative or branch.
Yeah. So if you think about most SD-WAN devices are using WireGuard. The WireGuard project is the routing engine, right? And really all you need to do is just tell WireGuard to set up some VPNs and give it some crypto keys and some configuration, and that's your edge device. And then you go and strap yourself in with an application inspection engine. You use a piece of open source software like J3 to fingerprint your TLSs, or you buy a commercial library off the shelf. That's the SD-WAN edge, right? It's trivial to do. I know of companies who've actually built their own SD-WAN appliances and controllers. Mm-hmm. Handful of developers, 9 months, three to six full-time staff, 9 months, and they built their own SD-WAN from the ground up. Yeah. You don't hear them talking about it because they're not allowed to talk out loud. They see it as a competitive advantage, right? Uh-huh. But, you know, you can build an SD. The trick is the controller part. Yep. And that's where the real magic happens.
Getting the metrics, where are your collector nodes, you know, what's the actual visibility? What's actually happening versus what do we see happening? And I think especially with voice like SIP and this and that, being able to actually look at some of those control plane messages would be very nice.
Yeah. Well, I think the value in SD-WAN isn't the actual load balancing of the SD-WAN and the configuration of the tunnels and all. That's actually table stakes now. The value of SD-WAN is in the analytics, so the visibility tools that you get with it. Yep. And then the second part is the configuration backups, the crypto key, you know, the operations, how quick and easy you can allow access to Microsoft Azure, click, Boom, done, right? And you don't even have to know what the IP address is. They've done all that work for you.
You just query. And that's very similar to what I'm saying about Lisp is you just query, right? You do your query. You say, I want to get to this. Are you allowed? Yes. Okay, here's how you get to it.
Yes. So I'm not against Lisp per se, except that if you're going to do it now, do little of it. Do the least amount. Don't bet it's going to be around in 20 years, because I suspect that, you know, the campus as it is, is probably passing us by much quicker than people think. Mm-hmm. And the idea that you will continue to build private networks for decade after decade is not something that's going to last for long. And so that type of technology, I think the data center will continue for much longer because there's much more entrenched there. Those apps don't change as fast. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the idea that a laptop can only connect to the private network and needs that software, that's a pretty old idea. And the weaknesses of that have been showing up during the pandemic situation that we've been living through for the last month or so.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Fun times. Well, I think that will wrap it up there. And thanks so much for joining me. So, Corey, why don't you tell people where they can find you on the internet?
So I've got a LinkedIn. You can find me there. My name's Corey Steele. And that's really the online presence I have is just LinkedIn. No Twitter. I don't like to tweet.
All right. Well, if you've enjoyed today's show and you think Corey's put up a good fight, or maybe I was a little bit brutal, whatever it is, whatever angle you want, head over to our follow-up page at packetpushers.net/FU and send us your FU and tell us what you thought. We'd love to hear from you. And if you've got another topic that you'd like us to cover, send it in. We can see if I can find somebody to have that debate about whether it is. And maybe that person is you. Love to hear from you. Tell us your feedback, good, positive, and negative. We can only get better if we know what we're doing wrong, and we can continue to do what we're doing right if we know it was the right thing and it appealed to you. As always, you can find the show notes for this episode in your podcatcher, but also on our website at packetpushers.net. And we've got thousands, literally, of other episodes, podcast episodes across our network on networking and cloud and a whole range of other things. So get over there and follow them. You can also follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Apple Podcasts and all that great stuff. And as always, last but never, ever least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.